Good morning, everyone. Last session before lunch. Thanks very much for coming to this session, which is about how to author your orchestrated runbooks. You'll have to figure my voice is my third session in a row, so I'm starting to get a bit croaky. So if I sound like the kid from The Simpsons, you know why. Oh, no, sorry, I've done it again. Just to get a show of hands so I know who I've got in the session, who knows what Orchestrator is, but has never actually, written a runbook in Anger. Good number. Okay. So my goal for this session for you guys is to give you tips that will save you more than an hour. Okay, so you're investing an hour in this session. I want you to get a positive return from that investment, so I want to save you more than an hour. Hopefully I'll do that. For people who have done a bit of runbook authoring in either the previous version of Parlous or in Orchestrator, there's some tips there that I hope some medium-level runbook authorers will get some stuff out of. And then towards the end of the session, I'm going to go through some more advanced techniques that would be beneficial to those of you who've done a fair bit of runbook authoring in the past. So the agenda for today, workflow, deployment and change, general structure. I'm just going to go through each of these things in turn. I won't read them out. Now, vast majority of this session, you'll be happy to know, is not a slide deck. So I've got one more slide and that's it. And then the rest of the time I'm going to spend in the runbook designer, actually having a look at how these things are put together. Unfortunately, a bit of a technical glitch we've had for some reason. I'm not able to display my demo screen up there and there at the same time. I can only get it up there. So the whole rest of the session, I'm going to be neck craning it to try and steer around the demo, and it's not easy to see on that monitor from here, so you'll just have to give me a little bit of leeway on that one. Okay. So first one, which is a best practice around how to treat your runbooks. Now, probably one of the most common things that I tend to see is you want to treat your runbooks like code. And I don't often see this primarily because Orchestrator obviously fits well in truly in the infrastructure guys space. And so therefore the people who tend to stand it up and author these runbooks and use them in most cases don't have sort of app development backgrounds. So they don't have good awareness of some of those good app dev development code promotion processes, things like that. That is important if you really want to run a sustainable Orchestrator environment. So you want to try and approach the authoring of these runbooks with really a degree of an application developer's mindset. One of the things that you can really take out of this is that if you're an infrastructure guy and you're not, don't know much about application development practices and things like the agile methodology, you do owe it to yourself to go and sort of, not expecting, go off and switch careers and become a hardcore dev, but to have a top-level view of those app development processes and things like code promotion and how you do that through tools like Team Foundation Server will be very beneficial to how you approach authoring your runbooks. So that's a good way that you guys can sharpen your saw. What I'm going to show you is a bunch of runbooks from an infrastructure as a service private cloud system that the services developed, and I'm going to show you those runbooks. And the reason why I put it in the context of that private cloud system is that there is really a new skill set that we're starting to call for within this private cloud environment. It's something we're calling the infradev, which is someone who is primarily an infrastructure guy and has all those infrastructure skills backing them, but also, again, knows those application development processes. And also, for those of you who were in Jeff's session, Jeff Woolsey's session on Server 2012 yesterday, can cut a mean PowerShell script. Again, for those of you who haven't really dipped your toe in the water of PowerShell, it's something that we highly recommend that you do. All of our products are coming now shipped on a PowerShell core. So things like Exchange Server, VMM, everything that does everything with those in those products is all PowerShell applets that drive all of those product functions. And the UI is just a convenience that's put down over the top for a little bit of ease of use. But everything is done under the covers through PowerShell. with a lot of those products, you'll see, like take VMM for example, when you go to issue a command in through the UI in VMM, in most cases, the last thing that you hit before you hit, yeah, commit this action, on the other side of the screen, there'll be a show script button. And that'll show you the script that VMM has generated under the covers to do that action. And that's a really good way to introduce yourself to PowerShell to say, okay, how are these products doing this? Take one of those pre-generated system scripts to then be able to modify and do things with. Even though when we demonstrate Orchestrator, we love the whole integration pack and drag and drop the things in. And look, it looks like Visio, and yeah. When you actually start doing serious automation through Orchestrator, the IPs are good and you can leverage them and they do save you some time. But in all honesty, you're not going to get too far before you start hitting things that you're going to have to write scripts for. And obviously that's where your PowerShell skills come in. So when we say treat it like code, we mean your Orchestrator runbooks are an asset. And you can check that asset in just like you would check in a piece of code. And using something like a tool like Team Foundation Server, Visual Studio is very useful for that because you can check in assets. It doesn't have to be code. It can be an Orchestrator runbook. It can be a script. It can be a document. Just about anything that you can consider an asset to that system. Versioning. Absolutely version your runbooks. One thing that we should hope we would never see is someone cracking open a runbook and making changes on the fly in production. No, that should be done in dev, tested, and then promoted up through your procedures. And my bullet point there is to say the only way that a runbook should be finding its way into production is if you're importing it from UAT or pre-production or whatever you call that staging environment. It should be validated in there, exported and imported into production. And when it's imported, then you're then obviously changing the version of that you're running. So if you had version 1.0, then you're importing version 1.2 or whatever it happens to be. Version those runbooks as you go through. It's very important. And keep a change log. You've got to keep a change log of what that runbook does and what changes you've made from version 1 to version 1.4 or whatever your versions are. Another way to approach this as well is, again, taking it back to Agile, is this idea of Agile release cycles or sprints. We decide, okay, for this first release of my runbook, what do I need this thing to do? And you set what those features are going to be, what it's going to achieve, and then you focus on that and you work on that. If you are halfway through the development of it, as often happens, is we get this kind of loose development where you're halfway through developing and go, oh, actually, it'd be really great if it could go out and do this thing as well. Don't change course as you're going through. You've set your set of features. You've set what that runbook's going to do. Finish that and get that stable and operational first. Those ideas of, oh, yeah, and I can add this, and then I can add this, and I can add this, great. Write those down, and then they can be implemented in the next version of that runbook. But it has to go through that cycle, that process of bedding in and testing and getting it all working before you promote it up and in. And change control. Obviously, implementing a new runbook is a change-worthy process. You shouldn't be implementing anything without adequate change and approvals. Again, this is not... Runbooks are not seen as... should not be seen as a BAU activity or something that you change on the fly. We find that as organizations get more and more, or they use Orchestrator more and more, they become more and more dependent upon it, you really want to... carefully control these things, because the consequences of a runbook breaking in some circumstances can be dramatic. It could be a process that on the scale that it needs to be done is simply not viable to be done manually, and you have to put whatever that processing is on hold until you can get the thing back up and running again. Another point that actually didn't make it onto that deck for some reason is documentation. Really got to have good, solid documentation around what you're doing. Document what your runbooks do. And that counts for both internal documentation, which I'll get into within the runbook, and good naming practices and those types of things, but also then external documentation in terms of what that runbook is achieving and how it goes about doing it. Again, you don't want a scenario where a runbook breaks and the person who authored that runbook is no longer with the organization. You're then into a situation where we know kind of what that end result is, but we don't know exactly how it goes about doing it, and it's not well enough internally documented that it's easily apparent, what those stages and what those processes are. So again, you really want to have them documented. This is all about control. Okay, so now I'm going to flick over to my demo machine. It's gone purple again. Can we? There we go. Anything I can be doing up here to help that? There we go.
Yay, well done.
Okay. Again, I'm going to have to neck crane this to show you this. This is going to be a bit tricky, but we'll get through it. So the first thing that I'm going to talk about is the general structure of your workbooks or your runbooks, sorry. Anyone who's done a technical writing course will know that when you're writing technical documentation that a short sentence is not a bad thing. You know, you don't have to be overly wordy. By the same token, a short run book is not a bad thing. Don't be afraid of having really, really short run books. So we like to make these things as modular as we possibly can, break them out into discrete functions, and have run books calling run books. So again, I'll put this in context of what you're looking at. Services developed in infrastructure as a service, a private cloud provisioning system based on System Center, and a lot of what that system does, it achieves the very high levels of automation that we talk about through a number of orchestrated runbooks. Now, the reason why I'm showing you this is quite often when we demo these types of things and we talk about these best practices and how to do them, you tend to the other approach is to just sort of author runbooks on the fly, on the demo to show you how these things fit together quickly. I figure there's only so much hello world you can deal with. But also when you start looking at those really quick, because they have to be really quick and dirty, right? Because you've only got a minute or two to bang these things out. They're not going to be very complicated. When you then try and take those theories and apply them to more complex run books, they're not as helpful anymore. So what I wanted to show you is a real world. These are the run books that we developed for this automation system, which we've deployed on many customer sites. These are battle tested. They're used in the real world. You know, this is how we really author our runbooks, and these are what production runbooks look like. So if I could just go across, I've got, as you can see, the way that we've broken it out. Firstly, we've got our top-level folder structure that says, okay, this is the system to which these runbooks belong, and then various initial tasks that, you know, these are all the runbooks grouped into these tasks. For example, VMD provisioning. We provision Linux workloads out of this system as well, so you've got specific tasks for Windows and Linux and then tasks which are common to all of them. We have that broken down into a folder structure, and then we also have then up the top discrete actions that are occurring within that. So this is really difficult to read. There we go. Like I said, no such thing, nothing bad about a short runbook. Again, modular, discrete actions, runbooks calling runbooks, which in Opalis, quite frankly, was a bit of a pain because the testing console wouldn't let you test that. You could only test individual runbooks. You couldn't, if a runbook called another runbook, you couldn't test it through the testing console. You had to go out to the web portal and execute it and test it from there. And anyone who's had the joy of installing the Opalis web portal will know what a pile of fun that was. That's much improved in Orchestrator. It's what you would expect a Windows product installation to be, and sort of, you know, a little bit of information supplied and largely next finish. You don't have to go trawling the web for all of these JBoss components. So you can see there as what we're doing, runbooks calling runbooks. So you can break down VM deprovisioning as an example into one sort of end goal that we want completed. And you can see how many of discrete tasks that we've got built into that function that then go out and then potentially call additional runbooks depending on what's happening. Again, it's about making them modular. One of the key advantages that we got out of making them modular within the context of this system was we first built the first cut of this a number of years ago, and it was back-ended by System Center 2007. Now, a lot of what we wanted out of a private cloud quite frankly, the System Center products didn't do out of the box. So we had to do a lot of extra functions in there to make it viable as a private cloud solution. A good example is what Jeff was talking about yesterday in terms of that cluster-aware updating. We've been doing that within this system for a while. Pre-2012, pre-System Center 2012, in backing in with 2007 and Windows Server 2008 R2, we had runbooks that orchestrated that, you know, put the first machine in the cluster in maintenance mode, evacuate, patch, confirm, bring it back in, wash, rinse, repeat through the cluster. So we had that as a set of runbooks. And then when VMM 2012 was released, it gave us the functionality to do that out of box. And because we kept our runbooks modular, it was very easy for us to take that custom pile of scripts and actions that we had that facilitated that, chuck them out, and then just plug in the, you know, plug in calling the out-of-box process, because we were able to basically remove that entire discrete module. And now looking forward to 2012, the cluster service is going to take that functionality out of the box. So again, it makes it very easy for us to adjust our runbooks. So the next thing I'm going to talk about is naming. So this really boils down to sort of an equivalent of internal code comments, you know, you document within code. Same sort of thing as we want to really try and document within the runbook as much as makes sense, as to be able to at a glance, be able to make sense out of what's going on. So you can see here that when you first drag particular items from your integration packs over into what we're doing, you know, over into here, they'll have a default name. You really want to go in and rename those to actually say, okay, well, what is this action specifically doing within the context of this runbook? So if I just go into one that, maybe not one that's quite so complicated. Within our general properties here, this is where we rename those. And it only takes you a minute or so, you know, as you're authoring your runbooks to go to. Just rename as you go. It's like my wife's always on me, clean as you go when you cook. It doesn't happen, but she tries. I'm going to be at you about, you know, name as you go with these actions. The first thing you should be doing after you've dragged the action onto the design pane in order to facilitate that action, name it. As soon as you drop it in, name it. It becomes really easy if you just do it as you go. The other place where it's really, really handy to name is within your linkages here. Now, firstly, this is my first time-saving tip for those who have never authored runbooks before. What you have is a set of discrete actions that then lead on to another action. And there'll be points in time where you may want to make some kind of a logic decision as to, no, I want to go down this path or I want to go down this path. So the first thing that'll potentially trip you up when you first start using Orchestrator is you go, okay, well, I've got two discrete paths here. I either want to go down this path or this path based on something that is happening within that action. So if I go into that action and have a look, then it's, that's just connecting into Service Manager and doing what it does, run behavior. It's not in there, so don't look. It's actually in the properties of the link itself. There you go. I just saved you 15 minutes of randomly clicking around and looking on Google. So this is the logic that's affected in order for it to go down that path. So while we're on naming, again, if I go into general, you can see that we've really followed our own best practices here, you can see. So we've actually really named that. We've named that link, which is just really intuitive and tells you exactly everything you need to know. So in terms of an action that just leads on to another action, that's probably not a bad thing, right? But here you can see, I've said error. This is just obviously what's happening here. If this succeeds, it's going to go here. If this fails, it's obviously going to go down that path. And by naming that, I've made it easy at a glance to tell what's going on. That really comes in handy when you look at something like, and I'm doing this all off VMs, and I have a single 7500 RPM spindle. So forgive the performance; she's not the quickest thing in the world. Okay, so if I have a look at our provisioning engine, for example, whoops, where are we? Or is it? Sorry, it's really hard to read from here. As you can see, this is about as big and as complex as you really ever want a runbook to get. Because by keeping it modular, you shouldn't really see anything too much bigger than this. This is pretty on the extreme side of how big and complex you want them. So you can see here that it's basically dependent on a particular status code as to what path it's going to go down. And I'll explain in detail how this provisioning engine works when I get towards the end and we get into the advanced section. For now, just know that it's easy to read that runbook because I've labeled those links appropriately and I know what they are. So if I go into the properties here, you can see in general, this is where I name it. Now, out of box, you're not going to see those links by default. So options, configure, and that show link labels. That by default it's unchecked. So just check that to get your link labels to display within the RAM designer. Okay, so now I'm going to cover off a little bit of a little bit on link logic. So what we saw just before there. Okay. So as an example, right, again I've got multiple paths that this runbook goes down. So it can either go along that path or it can go along that path. So let's have a look at how that link logic actually works and is applied. So you can see here that item, that guest request item, if that returns a success, then it's going to go down that path. And that's the default logic. So when you drag in an item and then drag in another item and link them, the default behavior will simply be if that item successfully executes, then I'm gonna go down that path. You can of course remove that particular item and replace it with whatever logic that you want to apply within that runbook. So the one next thing to notice is I can add multiple conditions. So I can say, okay, add another one. If, and I'm getting this from the get request item, which is actually running. If the cost factor, you know, equals zero as an example. Right, and you'll notice here that the OR parameter has come up. So it's basically saying, if my GET request returns success, or if my cost factor equals zero, if either of those two conditions are met, then it's going to go specifically down that path. Now, here's the next time-saving tip for you: is okay, that's great. How do I get an AND condition? I don't want an OR; I want an AND. If this and this is true, I want it to go down that path. You can't, so don't try. I just saved you half an hour of randomly clicking around and searching in Google. There is no way to change that operator to an AND. The way that you achieve that is through use of the exclude parameter here. Now, I'm going to say again, disclaimer, I'm from services, right? So I'm not from the product teams. I don't sell the products. I'm the one guy who goes down on site and tries to make them work. The amount of times that I've, why can't you do an AND parameter? I don't know. I didn't write it. It's just enough for me to tell you from a consulting point of view that you can't do it. So by using a combination of include and exclude, then you can get to your AND parameter from there. So it can be a little bit convoluted sometimes, and sometimes you need to be kind of map it out. Maybe in Visio or in a piece of paper or something, what that logic is going to be. But I've never encountered a logic condition that I couldn't meet through using a combination of the include and the exclude. So as an example, if I exclude and say add get request returns failed, so then that effectively is also turning this into an AND condition. Because if my cost factor equals zero, That's, of course, the OR, so there's the success. But if the only other option to success is failure, and you've got a failure condition in here that says if this return failed, do not go down that path, then that's effectively you've created an AND condition through a combination of those two things. I know it is a little bit of a brain teaser. Just think of it as something like, you know, when you're an experienced runbook author, that it's something you can do really well and, you know, makes you really special, and you can go and ask your boss for a pay rise. Okay, so that's some basic link logic and how the include and the exclude works. Something that I also want to articulate is, especially, and I'll get into this in sort of a little bit more detail when we go into doing error checking and these kinds of things, But when you're putting the logic into a link, and let's go a couple of stages down because that was the first one that I picked, and now we say, okay, properties. Now when I say add, you'll notice that I actually have some different options in here. So it's basically based on the, you know, which parameter am I actually talking about in terms of, you know, what action am I going to take. Now, what constitutes success and failure? Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, you can see here the multiple paths. It's not so much a logic path, you know, if I've got condition A, I want to do this, condition B, I want to do this. This is very specifically, you know, error checking. This is, you know, did I succeed? I go down here. If this task failed for whatever reason, then I'm going to drop out to an error routine. So, well, what constitutes a failure? It's an interesting question. So let me find one that has a script. Here we go. So again, I mentioned that the out-of-box IPs, like these ones, are great, but you know, it's not too long before you actually start hitting conditions where you need to script something up in order to get out of it what you need. So let's have a look at the properties of that. So you can see in this case we've got a PowerShell script here, and then obviously the code's included in that box. Now, a couple of things to say. Okay, well, how do I consume things within that? This is the first tip that I'll give you, because one of the great powerful things about Orchestrator is when you run scripts, and you know, they don't have to be PowerShell; they can be VB or Batch or you know, whatever .NET. Essentially, that's all going to be about taking some kind of input, grinding it through some kind of process, and then potentially spinning some kind of output out the back. So, let's have a quick look at how we actually consume these things. So you can see we've got a couple of variables here that we're saying, okay, this particular variable is, and that blue text denotes that, yes, this I'm actually getting that from the data bus within Orchestrator. So instead of actually hard coding the variable within the script, I'm taking that variable in as whatever the data bus gives me. So if I So in order to get that in, people keep trying to type it and realize why the hell won't it work? It's not coming up blue like the other one does. Tip, don't do that. Just saved you 15 minutes, and by my calculations, the session just paid for itself. So right-click, subscribe. And you can then either subscribe to variables within the system or to publish data. If I subscribe to publish data, then it's going to be giving me options of things that have occurred previously within that runbook. So if this script is stage 4, when I say I want to subscribe to publish data from the data bus, you're going to have any output from any of the previous 3 actions as something that can be you know, inputted into that script for use. And when we say runbooks calling runbooks, when you say, okay, I want to call another runbook, you tell it when you call it what parameters you want to pass to that runbook. And then the first action within that runbook will be a custom start. And within the properties of that custom start, you're reiterating what parameters am I taking from the runbook that just executed or just called me to be executed. I'll illustrate that when we look at the error checking in a little bit more detail. But you can see that I can pick any output at all from any of these previous actions. So we can say, okay, if my cloud value, you know, equals that cloud value, and then I can pump that into some logic at the end. And I'll go into the use of variables in a second as well. So down the bottom here as well, we've got some final variables that this is information that we want to put back out to be consumed by other things in the data bus. So we've got those variables declared within the script. And then if I go into my published data, you can see that these the variable, the type, is then, you know, whether it's a string or a boolean or an integer or whatever it is, is then specified within the data bus, and that's how you take output from your scripts and then have them from the data bus for other actions and other runbooks to consume. There is a way, however, an issue you might run into is if you do a lot of PowerShell, you really get to know how powerful PowerShell is in terms of the ability for particular variables to be complete arrays of data. Orchestrator doesn't like that very much. The data bus doesn't know how to handle a populated variable in that way. So there is actually a syntactical way that you can effectively get it to output as a string on the data bus and then be reformatted as it comes back in if it's to be consumed by another script. My advice is to not try that on your first runbook. get a little bit comfortable with the processes and how the data bus works before you start attempting stuff that's a little bit more advanced like that. Okay, so the next thing I'm going to cover off are global settings. So within global settings, we've got variables, counters, and schedules. So variables are variables, funnily enough. So just to give a little bit of background, a lot of this content as to where these best practices have come from has come from the Orchestrator team. There's a guy in the Orchestrator team by the name of Charles Joy who's done a lot of work with making this sort of content publicly available. He's got a blog where he blogs all the time. He loves recording YouTube videos. There's about 3 odd hours worth of content of YouTube videos that he's recorded on various aspects of runbook authoring and how to best do it within the system. So at the end of my deck, I've actually got a reference to his blog and a lot of the work that he's done in terms of all of those references. So this is just like an introduction. I can't fit all of his content down into an hour, but I'm giving you the main sort of hit points if you've never done it before. And then once you start authoring runbooks, go back, look at that blog, and start leveraging his resources because he really will make your life a lot easier, consuming that content. Save you a lot of time in making mistakes. So variables are obviously something that we set in here that it can be globally consumed by any runbook in the system. This is just sort of, basic good coding practices 101, really. It's don't hard code values when you can use variables. If I'm pointing to a particular server for a connection, or if I'm wanting to dynamically add something to a collection in Config Manager, for example, because I want to deploy an app as part of my deployment process, these things like the collection ID, that's a perfect use for a variable. Don't put it in the runbook because A, it may change from environment to environment as you promote things through the process. Things like server names are a classic example of when you promote from dev, test, pre-prod, and change though, those values are going to change through those environments. So you want those things set as global variables. So as long as you're referencing the variable in your runbooks, you can import those, and then whatever the setting is in that particular environment, that's the setting that'll take, and that's the way you want to do it. You don't want to go back and having to be making changes internally within your runbooks. So, this is pretty self-explanatory. If you have a value, you have a description, and then you actually have what the value of that particular variable is. You can see we've got a couple of account names and server names and that sort of thing in there. There are a couple of special use or specific variables which are handy to know about, so I'll go through those. So I'm just going to say new variable. So that's basically just pull whatever the current time and date is. Again, without going into too much detail, if you go and look at Charles Joy's YouTube videos, he's actually got a whole section on how you can easily manipulate that data and format it so that it comes out in the format that you want and be consumed within your runbooks. Another one, I was just complaining that I'd actually already added that before, is system variables. Back to the old days of batch, they're still really, really useful. And very easy to consume. So if I want, for example, program files, that's simply, whoops. I cannot read that. Exactly as you would in batch. So that's how you just denote that within that variable and a very, very handy thing to consume. usernames and passwords are another good use for variables in terms of if you're having to obviously use usernames and passwords to connect to various systems or do various things, depending on how you've got your security for Orchestrator set up, whether or not you're using, highly privileged service accounts, or you've got a really strong delegated model where only specific accounts can do very specific things. If you're more to the delegated model side, then sure, you've got connector accounts, but that doesn't facilitate everything that you need. So usernames and passwords as variables is also a very handy use. You'll note as well, and I wouldn't have made that recommendation with Orchestrate with Opalis because we didn't have that. But in Orchestrator now we do, so you can put your passwords in there. So that's encrypting it, obviously, within the UI. So when you go back and have a look at the UI, what the value of that is not displayed, and it's also encrypted within the database, and it just gets passed straight through when the runbook executes. So those are variables in a nutshell. So the next handy use of something is a counter, and a counter is surprisingly something that counts. We do try and keep this, simple in terms of what we name things. It's very useful in terms of normally when you want a counter to execute within something, you'd be tempted to sort of do that within a script. But again, I mean, you can feed data in and out of a script on the data bus, as I showed you, but trying to do that with a counter is not really an efficient way of doing it. You wouldn't want to say, okay, I want to count something, so I'll loop into a script that does that for me. You can actually do it out of box using the Orchestrator facility. So again, simply you just create a new count, give it a name, and what its default start value is. Now, a good use case for a counter within the context of a runbook is you might have a service which, isn't the most reliable thing in the world. It may sort of fail on a regular basis. But it may have different levels of failure. You might say, okay, if it fails twice, then, if it's failed twice, I want to take this particular action. If it's failed five times, I want to take a different action. So we can use that counter within a runbook, or you can say, okay, I've run this repair action. I've run a runbook which runs a specific repair action. If that hasn't worked twice, then I want to then undertake a different action, for example. So we've got our counters in here, and I'm just going to go into any old runbook, and I'm going to actually break my own rule and kind of do a hello world thing here. So within this is where it gets interesting. In utilities, this is where we have our counters for the counts. Now, I can't really read that, but you'll see in there. So it's going to be difficult for me to drag it across. You can see there's the get counter value just sort of there. So that's obviously where we're pulling in. You say get counter value, and it'll simply say, okay, you right-click. And within the properties of that, it's going to say, okay, what counter is it? What's your counter? So then it's going to go ahead and get the value of that counter. So the next action is, okay, I want to do something to that counter. And the properties of that counter are I can increment it, I can decrement it, I can set it to a specific value, or I can reset it. So that can be a fairly powerful thing when you start applying that to your runbooks to say, okay, I've run this, okay, this error's occurred, I've detected it. I'm going to go pump it into the runbook that takes corrective action. First action within that runbook will be get counter. If my value is less than 2, go down this particular path to say, okay, this is the corrective action, call another runbook, which this is this corrective action number 1 that I want you to take. When it gets to the end of that, increment your counter by 1. And then, or say, okay, if that corrective action was successful and I've now confirmed the system's online, you can reset the counter to 0. You can see where I'm going. Next time it runs and that event triggers, get the counter. If it's a 2 or above because that corrective action hasn't worked, then go off down the secondary path and take another corrective action. I mean, just as an example as to how counters can be used. Now, the third one is schedules. Schedules are actually quite a powerful tool, and it's something that kind of gets ignored a lot of the time, I find. So a schedule is simply, okay, I've got a schedule here that I've just called after hours. And we can look, we're quite granular. Again, you can see this exceptions logic that the Orchestrator team just love. So you can say, okay, specific days of the week, I want a specific occurrence to happen within particular times of the month. I can say, right, particular day within the month. I can set, specific hours within that it will and that it won't run. And then once you've set all those, to your heart's content, you can say, right, well, the exceptions to that I want is I want it to run every Monday for every month except for my mum's birthday. You know, whatever logic you want to apply to that. So it's quite flexible into how you do that. So the use case for that is primarily associated with monitoring runbooks. So if you've got a runbook which is there, you know, either checking every 5 minutes for an action or something along those lines, or looking for a journal change on the file system for when you drop a new file into a directory, or you know, whatever your trigger action is, you might say, okay, I want this monitoring runbook to run, but only during the specific schedule time intervals that I set within that schedule. So now that we've actually configured that schedule, you actually apply that at the runbook layer here. So I go into here and then properties, and then I've got, where is it? Schedule here. So I can say, right, that will then only run to that specific schedule. So you can have that with other, not just monitoring runbooks, but specific actions as well. Say, you know, to trigger it off to say, okay, I want to, you know, page a particular person or do whatever I want to do, but that's only going to run, you know, out of business hours, or otherwise then I'm going to rely on my other alerting system. And just a reminder, that's per runbook. Yep. Based on time zone. Yep. Yep. That's a tricky one. That's going to be, and this is going to come to how you architect your orchestrator distribution in terms of where your action servers are. It's going to go off its local, the action server is going to execute that based off its local clock. So if you've got a data center in Japan and your action server is in Japan, then it's going to be after hours appropriate for Japan. So you have to be aware of where is the action server that's executing that in relation to its local time. And you can actually say with a runbook, I want this runbook to launch specifically on this action server and no other. So if you've got a runbook that is your after-hours escalation process for Japan, you'd say only execute that on the Japan action server. A little bit of a convoluted way of doing it, but yeah, it's achievable.
Just on that, if it's, say, if you're trying to execute a runbook and it's set to disallow, will that run the hours, if the window, or is it just flat-out denies?
It doesn't queue, it just flat-out denies. Where am I up to? Error handling. Yay. That's my favourite one. So, again, I take a bit of an agile approach to this. I wouldn't try and crack on with this for your very first runbook, but it's certainly something that once you start to get a little bit more comfortable, you really need to start thinking about applying to all your runbooks. You probably noticed as I've clicked through a lot of these runbooks that we use that just about every action, not every action, but just about every action, you can see has an error link, which then pumps out that little three-coloured box is basically go and execute another runbook. That's our error routine. So anything that happens, if this get request, so if I have a look at the properties of the error link, okay, if get request returns a failure, then it's going to go down that path. So then again, if I have a look at... I don't want to delete it. Okay, so you can see here that that's now calling the error routine runbook, and here's all the parameters that it's gathering, all the information from the data bus that it's gathering from that failed object, and it's going to pump it back out. So then, if we go up and have a look at our error routine, you can see here our custom start contains all of that information that we're actually passing from the previous runbook to say go over and grab all of this stuff in here. So stuff like error state, you know, error message, activity ID, request ID, all that kind of stuff. So here, as an example, what we're doing here is first thing we're doing is pumping that information out to the event log, and then within the context of this system, everything that we log, every activity that we do is logged as a record in Service Manager, so we have good process control through Service Manager. If it detects a failure, it's going to now go out and raise an incident report in Service Manager saying, this runbook failed at this process, here's the process name, here's the process ID, here's the error, and pump all that information out. It makes one of those more complicated systems more viable to use from an administration point of view, because if it fails anywhere along the line, and some of your runbooks, when they start getting complicated, troubleshooting them can be a really time-consuming exercise. So you need this logging and error checking to be able to come out and say, yes, I failed here. Here's where you need to go and look to work out why this runbook failed. So what's a failure? This is an interesting question. If we look at something that has a script associated with it, and I have a look at this error condition, scripts are a good example, because you can say, if my script execution fails, then go down this error path. Well, what does that mean? It means that the script successfully ran. The script may not have the output that you wanted or were expecting to see. So it can trip you up sometimes to say, well, the runbook says that this action is working, but the result I want isn't happening. Why is that? Well, it can successfully execute the script as long as the script doesn't throw a big exception and crash because you've given it a wrong applet name or something. It's going to say, yeah, I successfully completed and I'm happy. It may not return the value that you want. You may be expecting to consume some piece of information you're pulling out and it's giving you a null return. Well, null's still a return. So it's going to log that as a success. So you can see for this script, you can say, okay, if the actual running of that script has failed, that's one condition. Or another condition is within the script, if my error state variable is a particular value, then I'm going to classify that as an error as well and dump out to the error routine. And you can see within the script, because I don't want to delete it, a couple of the things that we're doing here, and one of the references that I've included in the back of the deck is the ability to is a place to go and look up how to do good error trapping in PowerShell, so you can include that in your scripts. You can see that we've got error state codes that we maintain through that. And then the other variable that we maintain is this trace variable, which is just basically grabbing the output of, okay, I've done this, I'm going to pump it into this variable. Very, very useful. So then at the end, I'm going to say, right, well, I've got this trace, at the end of it, which is the log of what's happened through that script. And we're pumping that out as published data, which then you can see gets pumped out to the error routine. There it is down the bottom. And then when I looked at the properties of that error routine, that's the data that it was accepting. So whatever error gets thrown by the script, we're just going to pump that value straight out. And then in this case, what I get raised in Service Manager says, yeah, it failed here, and here's the error message that the script gave me. Sometimes it might be something really meaningful. Sometimes it's just a random hex code, but at least it gives us something to start from. And so that's a quick one on error handling. And something that is really good policy to have in your scripts. To finish off, I'm just going to go through, tell you about a couple of advanced techniques. Now, the first advanced technique I'm going to go through is this provisioning engine that we've built for in this particular case, for VM provisioning. So you can see there, like I said, pretty big, pretty unwieldy, as complicated as you want it to get. What we're doing here, what we're achieving, is a degree of state management within our runbook. And this has a couple of real advantages for us. The first one is some of your runbooks that you author might be, really quick, fraction of a second execution items, that's fine. Some of them might be a lot longer. I mean, when we're talking about provisioning of machines, if you're bare metal building a physical server from Config Manager or whatever, as anyone who's ever done deployment testing will tell you, it's a time-consuming thing. These task sequences can run for a while. And you don't want your runbook in a loop going, are you done yet? Are you done yet? Are you done yet? Are you done yet? It's not an efficient way to write your runbooks because it consumes memory, it consumes resources on the orchestrator box, and once you start executing, when you test, you tend to do these things one at a time, but you've got to think about your scale. How many simultaneous runbooks is this server? Am I expecting this server to handle? If it's a big system, you could be managing hundreds or thousands of simultaneously running runbooks. You don't want hundreds of runbooks going, are you done yet? Are you done yet? Are you done yet? Are you done yet? You potentially bring the server down with that kind of activity. So we want to, again, make them very modular and very discrete. So we achieve our state management through a service manager ticket in this example. You could do it any number of ways. You could have a log file, you could have an entry in a SQL database, or however you want to. The method of, from that point of view, is irrelevant. The point is to have a ticket in the system that has a status on it that the system reads. So when someone raises, again in this example, I want to provision a VM, that gets raised as a change record in Service Manager. We have an orchestrator runbook that goes and reads all of the open status requests in Service Manager and picks them up and then churns them through this provisioning engine. So it just looks at the status code on the job and says, right, you're status one. That means I know that you've just been freshly approved and I need to undertake my first action with you. I'm going to go down the status one path. That's going to initiate the deployment of whatever template was requested through VMM. Once it starts that deployment process, it's going to go, right, I've started it. I'm going to mark you now as status two, and I'm going to close the runbook and finish. Done. That has gracefully completed as far as that run is concerned. Next time we go through another run, pick up all the open records, go, oh, you're at status two. That means it's running. Let's take you to the runbook that actually checks your status and sees if you're finished. If you're not finished, I don't update the status. I gracefully complete, and I wait for the next run. If you are finished, I mark the status 3, complete, wait for the next run. You can see where I'm going with this. So in terms of end-to-end execution time, it does actually increase it a bit because you're not going from task to task to task to task, because that's very quick. We're going task, log it, complete, wait for my next cycle of picking up the open jobs. And in this example, our system goes and checks every 5 minutes to see if there's open jobs that need to be actioned. So for the completion of a task, it might be a few seconds before it gets to the next task, or it could be 4 minutes and 59 seconds. It just depends on where it is in that refresh cycle. So you are increasing that sort of end-to-end time to complete, but the benefit that it gives you is very, very, is extreme in terms of this modular design. Think what happens if a process in here fails. How do you deal with that? If you're authoring a one run book which just goes end to end, it's 20 processes long, if you fail on process 6, what do? You restart the job? How does that job then treat stages 1 to 6 if they've already been executed? Are they going to fail because it's not seeing a state that it expects? So this modularity and this routing engine gives us the ability to say, okay, you failed the process at stage 6. I know that. So I know where you are in the process. I now want to restart that job. And because it's modular like this and has a status code, I can say, right, do I want to restart from the beginning? Do I want to start from stage 6? Or do I want to skip stage 6 and move to stage 7? And that gives you that repeatability of being able to rerun your runbooks from the failed step, which in terms of testing saves you so much time, being able to say, no, I want to start from this discrete action and not have to run through my whole runbook again and ignore the failures that I know that I'm going to get because I'm already in a completed stage. Now, this routing engine's, again, based on Service Manager, but it can be anything that, you know, that state management can be done any way that you want. Another option for you is Charles Joy's written a system very similar to this, using a SQL database. So what he's done is he's given you all of the SQL commands you need to actually set up this database on a SQL server, and he's written an integration pack with items in it to actually then interact with that database. So when you initialize your first action, one of the drag and drop from his integration pack is then to say, okay, go and log that this action started in the SQL database. And then after that, you can log whether it's failed, whether it's succeeded, whether it gave you a warning. And those failure and warning conditions in the SQL database also have an additional reset flag on them. So you can actually then restart that job from where the SQL database is telling you that the failure occurred. So slightly different way of achieving the same goal, but ultimately results in the same thing. So again, not something you want to try and knock over for your first runbook, but you know, definitely an advanced technique that once you're comfortable with your authoring is something that you can bring to bear to make your runbooks more efficient. Okay, that was all I had for that. I'll just flick back to the deck and show you the references. The deck is available post session, obviously, so you don't need to go taking photos or frantically writing stuff down. The deck will be posted, obviously, on the TechNet site after the event. So those references are there for you to go and investigate at your leisure. So what I've got in there is the link to the Charles Joy's blog and Runbook Authoring Best Practices. There's hours and hours and hours of content to consume there. He puts a lot of other stuff like that job checking module up on Codeplex, so you can download and consume that. And he's just updated all of that stuff to run with Orchestrator from Opalis. I've also included a link to a migration link as well. If you currently have Orchestrator and you're looking to move to Opalis, there are some things that you need to consider. There are some got-yous in there. Some legacy objects have been discontinued. From Opalis to Orchestrator. Some legacy objects have been discontinued. Also, certain actions that you used to be able to take within a runbook you no longer can, like a looping runbook, for example, isn't permitted anymore. So you just need to be aware of some of those gotchas. And I've supplied a link to that as well. So that pretty much wraps me up. At this stage, happy to take any questions that anyone has about Orchestrator. Sorry? Yep. Do you want to go back to the slide deck? Or? Yep. Yep. Go. And there's also some, they call it policy, because we used to call runbooks policies in Opalis. Some authoring examples there, but vast majority of what's there also holds true for Orchestrator. Yep, there's a question. Offer a remote desktop. Yep. Yes, that's right. Yes, I mean that's the local execution point, right? So, quite a lot of the stuff that we do, certainly within this system, is that if you actually go and look at a lot of the action servers, you'll see, the VMM consoles installed because we need the PowerShell applets, and yeah. So all those things need to be local. Yeah, to the integration packs, yes, but then if there's other code that's required within those, because sometimes the integration packs will have everything you need, sometimes they won't. Like the PowerShell applets for VMM is a great example. Yeah, the IPs don't contain that if you want to then go and do additional PowerShell scripts to integrate with VMM that's not included in the integration pack. Anyone else?
I have a question about the counters. It might be a little bit simple.
Yep.
You know, after a runbook finishes running, and then you say you can go back and check a value.
Yep.
Once again.
Yep.
How does that work?
Okay, so you've got a reset option within those actions that I showed you within the utility section. So you can either increment, decrement, set to a specific value, or reset to the default value. So if you want to reset it after a particular action, you bring in and you bring in that reset, and it'll reset it back to whatever that initial value that you set was when you created the counter in the first place. No, it's ladder counter library. Yeah, and it maintains a state within the data bus for each runbook that's executing. Yep. Whatever's installed in the box. Yeah. So you do have to be careful again if you're looking at what PowerShell version you have on your action servers, and that you're authoring, to the right to the right version of PowerShell, and again potentially what target it's executing to as well, and what it's doing. So yeah. Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time, everyone, and enjoy your rest of your time at TechEd.